at the root of this Bible study is the concern that's come out of the South African church as it's faced the issues of racial and ethnic tension, and perhaps something that we can share and think about today. I want to start the early church, and then we'll do a rapid bringing it into the present. The early church began in a pretty racially and ethnic homogeneous community. If you think about it, Jesus was a Jew, the disciples were all Jews, the apostles were Jews, Jesus was circumcised, the apostles were all circumcised, Jesus attended the Passover meals, the apostles all did that. The early church really grew up in the Jewish community, and in fact, early church historians tell us it was only with the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem by the Romans in the 70s, after the Common Era, that Christianity and Judaism officially parted company. So you had this pretty ethnic, racial, and compounded with it a religious commonness that held the church together. But all of us are products of the fact that the church grew in the Gentile world too. That the church broke through those boundaries, and particularly through the missions of Paul, Barnabas, and in Asia Minor, a whole lot of people who were not Jewish suddenly started becoming Christians. And probably the earliest struggle in the church was precisely what to do with us, Gentiles, our parents, ancestors. Did everybody have to become a Jew to become a Christian? And today's Bible study, I want to start us with that question that the early church struggled with. And what I'd like us to do is, I have two passages, and what I'd like you to do is to get into little groups of two or three and to choose one of the passages and to read it and to talk about it, and then we can get a collective response to how the early church grappled with this issue. So perhaps just choose two or three people that you'd like to talk with, or who would like to talk with you. The smaller the better, because then people get a chance to talk. Even two will be fine. Even two. I'll give them now once people are settled. Are you? Okay, you've got people. If you're in a group of four or more, please cut that in half. I tell you why. It's simply we don't have enough time for everybody in the group. It's just a buzz group. You're just going to throw ideas around very, very quickly. And so it breaks the whole point of it. We might as well stay in the large group if we're more than two or three. Okay. Perhaps all the groups on this side of the poll and me, and that means that group of five has now been divided in half, because they're going to have different... Okay. If you could do Acts 15, the book of Acts 15, verse 1 to 11. Now, this is going to create a certain amount of hilarity, because you're going to have to read it in your small groups. You can either decide to read it individually, silently, or somebody in the group can read it loudly, and we'll all laugh through that one. And on this side, I'd like you to look at Romans 3, verse 19 to the end of the chapter, 19 to 31. If you could read it through and then say how you think these passages deal with the problem of Gentiles and Jews becoming Christians. Acts 15, 1 to 11. Now, this is going to be a difficult thing for somebody in this group to do. Could somebody tell the Bible story without any of your own or your group's theology in it? Just so that this group knows what Acts 15 is all about. If somebody could just briefly...
Can we vote on that?
Yeah.
Is anybody here good at storytelling? If you could just very briefly say what Acts 15 is about, because I'm sure people here would like it refreshed. Okay.
I'll volunteer. Paul and Barnabas had come back from their first missionary journey, and they went to Antioch, which was the congregation that had sent them out. And Antioch rejoiced, the people rejoiced at the Jews, or the Gentiles, coming into the church. But there were some people that heard about it down in Judea, and they came up and said, you can't accept these people in the church unless they're circumcised, unless they come under the law of God. And so a delegation was sent down to Jerusalem to consider this question. Paul and Barnabas were among them. They had a big meeting, and they talked about it a long time. The Pharisees said the same thing as the people that had come up to Antioch. And Peter got up finally and said, after the long discussion, and said, you can't do that because God has clearly shown in the conversion of Cornelius, which happened in chapter 10, God has clearly shown that he has accepted the Gentiles on the same basis as us, not on the basis of being obedient to the law, but on the basis of faith.
Great. Does anybody want to add anything to the story? Is anybody here unclear about any of the plot? Okay.
There's only one thing I'd like to comment about, and that is that...
Can we hold comments for... Is this got to do with the plot of the story?
No, well, yeah.
Okay.
Maybe not.
I'd just like to get the two groups got their ideas out, and then we can perhaps have some kind of fruitful integration.
Steve, I have a question about the setting. Do you know which Antioch this is? Is the one closest to the Greek world, or is it the one that's...
Of Syria, Antioch of
Syria.
Okay.
Okay, the group on this side, does somebody want to just... Now, this is not a story. This is Paul's writing a letter. But if somebody had to just precede the letter, give a shortened summary of what Paul is saying there. It's more difficult. Okay.
The congregations in Rome apparently were divided on the issue of whether or not the Gentiles were... to be admitted to the full status as Christians. And the debate was perhaps growing in some intensity, and St. Paul provides a theological answer on the basis of his understanding of the role of Christ and the fact that the religion of the Jews was essentially a legalistic religion which depended on the observance of Jewish traditional religious forms which were not familiar to the Gentile or the Roman segment of the congregations. And Paul states theologically then that boasting about the law is unacceptable, and because no one is saved that way, they're saved only by a faith. God is God of all men, all persons, not just Jews, all Gentiles as well. So it's a theological answer to a parish problem.
Good. Thank you. Yeah. And the reason I think you've just mentioned there, a theological answer to a parish problem, how often we read these things of Paul's letters, particularly the letter to the Romans, and think that this is Paul sitting in his... university office writing theology, but is in fact rather a pastor struggling with the practical problems of the church in the early day. Right, we've got then a practical situation and Peter's response and the experience of the Council of Jerusalem, and then Paul struggling with that. Now we can put aside our storytelling and getting up to date with the particulars. How do you think the church, I mean, what was it that enabled the church then to deal with this question, and what do you think the issues were that the church had to face as they were moving between Jew and Gentile? Do you want to kick it off with your...
Well, my
sort of observation was that it's the law. When he was summarizing, he said the law of God. I say it's the law of God as interpreted by people, and so I think that that's very relevant in the sense that in translation, the law of God sometimes gets skewed. And so the skewed interpretation gets to be the basis for whatever, for foundation for whatever structure you're building. And so I think that, we have to keep that in mind. I'm thinking especially of, you talked about South Africa, of the Tower of Babel story, in that context being used as a sort of theological basis for separation. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying that that's a skewing of the real intent. And the same thing with this. It's a skewing of the intent of what is necessary to be saved. You know, is it necessary to complete? There's another place in Acts where they talk about the dietary laws too. And, you know, is it necessary for the Christians to observe the dietary laws as the practicing Jews do? And, you know, so I think it's a human interpretation of a divine sort of commandment. So the divine commandment is not off, but certainly the human interpretation is. And I think that still continues in our church and in our persons.
Is there any way to receive the divine commandment except by human interpretation?
Yeah, well, no, except that it has to be constantly reinterpreted.
No matter who interprets, though, it's not sufficient.
No, and I think it has to constantly be reinterpreted because situations change and everything.
I think there's kind of a...
Sorry, what was the question?
I couldn't hear this.
Do you want to turn your chair?
What the interpretation?
It doesn't matter what the interpretation is. It doesn't matter who has skewed in terms of interpreting the law. No matter how the law is interpreted, it's not the basis. It's not the basis ever of salvation.
It's a striving. We have to continually strive toward it, and that's what we're doing here. Don't you think?
We do strive
to interpretation.
No, there's a sense in which the Lutheran dangers quietism by not striving, so I agree with you.
Okay. I was just thinking at the Council of Jerusalem, I think that Paul was a very practical theologian. I mean, he was out there in the field as a practitioner. Mm-hmm. And the Lord said as he left, "Go ye therefore and preach to all the nations, baptizing and teaching." Now the practical thing is, how can you do that in spite of the theology which he explains in Romans? They are very practical matter. How can we get it out to the world? And if circumcision is going to be the hindrance to preaching the gospel and baptizing and teaching, they've got to come to grips with that problem, even though it's quite a few years later. Nonetheless, I think that you cannot spread the gospel unless you see what God's intention is for all people.
Let me try something on you as a possibility. Can I wipe this off now? You've got a feel for what's going on here. Particularly those of you in the Lutheran tradition. The cry justification by faith was one of the things that Luther picked up on and was really important in terms of making a critique of what he perceived as the theology of glory of the Catholic Church at the time. And to a large extent, we tend to, especially those of us in the Reformed tradition or the Reformation tradition, the Protestant tradition, tend to explore the whole justification by faith thing as Luther set it up, as a kind of law-faith dialectic. I mean, you're either on the one side or on the other. Would that be true, I mean, in terms of the kind of preaching and thing we thought about? And it's certainly there. But the thing that interests me, and this is particularly from a reading from within South Africa, is that is the law as was perceived to be as some kind of religious principles, or to what extent is Paul struggling with the law as some kind of cultural expression of what it meant to be Jewish? In other words, if you had to define what Jewishness was, in other words, what was the cultural identity of the people? It's the law thing. And so the dialectic comes, and this is where the title of this thing comes, it's not so much the faith law issue, but the faith face issue. What does your face look like? Is it white? Is it black? Is it Jewish? Is it Gentile? Have you got this kind of hair? It's more ethnic, racial, cultural that Paul is struggling with as the kind of issue that he's facing. I've got some more stuff to say, but let me stop there. Do you think that's way off base, or do you think that that's part of some of the dynamic going on here?
As opposed to law in terms of principles that all human beings accept and operate.
Well, I'm not too sure. You know, I'm not trying to undermine the law thing. I think the law thing is there, and Paul has to grapple with that. But what I'm wondering about, and this is where I'd like to have some responses, perhaps we read it. You see, in Luther's day, what he was struggling with were the religious laws put out by the Catholic Church, which sets up this thing, and that's definitely there in the Bible. And Paul did speak about that. But one of the things that perhaps Paul is also struggling with is that it's precisely the Jew-Gentile debate, which is a racial, ethnic debate as well as a religious one.
One of the things that I never noticed before in reading this text is, and I'm sorry, I only have good news, so if somebody has an RSV, maybe check this out, but in the Acts text, in verse 10, it seems to be much more of a cultural thing than I ever noticed before. So then, why do you want to put God to the test now by laying a load on the backs of the believers, which neither our ancestors nor we ourselves were able to carry? I remember that for a long, long time, I thought that circumcision was unique to the Jews. And after traveling and teaching in New Guinea, finding out that circumcision is a common practice in all kinds of cultures, and then to have people who are outside of that practice say, neither our ancestors nor we have ever been able to see why you did this. And so why should we now, just because we have come into the faith as you are in the faith? And so it seems to me that has really popped out at me this time. It seems to be cultural.
Okay.
I don't see it as an either or. I think that some of the culturalness can be expressions of the law.
Yeah.
The law can easily be all those things to which we're tempted to put our faith in, as opposed to putting our faith in God. And so cultural expressions can easily fit within that framework of what is legalistic.
Right. And it kind of became, I mean, that the Jewish, if one did very simply, the Jewish way to salvation was law, salvation. I mean, would that be people happy with that? For the Jewish,
no.
That one went through the law to reach salvation. That would be the basic understanding. So, did you?
I'm disagreeing with that.
But for the average Jew, at the time, that would be an understanding of how one got salvation. Mm-hmm. Fine, okay. The fact that we disagree with it is precisely part of the discussion.
The reluctance to go. Martin Luther didn't intend to become a Protestant. I mean, he was holding on to that Catholic, attempting to reform and change the Catholic nature of his religion. Until he got across, it was very difficult to become the evangelist that he was. I think that's true of Peter and Paul, not so much Paul, but Peter, as the head of the church now, had a difficult time, I think, moving away from that which was comfortable for him, as we do. It's hard for us to make the transition and to move out to do that which has to be done if you're going to spread the good news. Or to live the life. I think. I have some thought.
Okay, let me take these two responses and then I'll come back to you.
I mean, Paul is dealing particularly with the distortion of law. There's a law which is the divine law, the eternal law, so to speak, and then there's the distortion of the law which had become a ceremonial observance of regulations and rules.
Okay.
And it was this particular aspect of law to which Paul is dealing, because later on he says, now is the law of none effect, I mean, by all means. So it's again, it's not either or, it's a both and.
law and faith, law and gospel.
Okay. And that's what I was going to say, is that to a large extent, these two had at this time become kind of synonymous, that being Jewish was obeying the law, and obeying the law was being Jewish. And if you asked somebody to define what it was to be Jewish, it would be the males would be circumcised, we would obey all those kinds of things. And you have to understand too that the law, we often think of it like this, and the reformers tried to say that the law was the Ten Commandments. But for Jews, the law was also all those dietary laws, all those practices. In other words, what established them as Jewish people in the face of hostility from the world around them? Do you want to come back on this?
Okay, I'm agreeing with you that the common, ordinary perception at the time of Jesus is that Jews are saved by the law or attain salvation through the law. I don't think, and I'm coming off of Paul Saunders' book, Paul and Palestinian Judaism, I don't think that you can derive that very much unless you very carefully read the Talmud and the other theological works of that time. I think there is, and I think it's the reason why Jesus has so much fellowship with the Pharisees and virtually none of the Sadducees, is that the Pharisees have almost got it. They're able to talk to him. They don't disagree except on the cultural basis of definition of identity, of what it means to be Israel. When you look at Exodus chapter 19, which was the passage for this Sunday, God establishes the covenant, you be my people, and the people reply, everything that you say, we will do. Then you get to the law. There is the relationship that is established first with God, and then it is the law that begins to define who these people are. And the law becomes a gift to the people of God.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not disagreeing with you on that. I think that that's a rereading back.
Let me finish, okay?
Okay.
And no, I think it's there at that time. I think that's why Jesus can talk to some of the Pharisees and not all of them. But what happens, not only to Jews who think that through the law we can be saved, but Christians think that it is belief in Jesus that saves us in the same attitude.
Okay. Thanks. The point though that I'm trying to make here, and I'm not disagreeing with you, but I think that's going into another issue that could make up another Bible study maybe, is that to a large extent, the cultural, religious, and ethnic thing of being Jewish tied up with what it meant to be saved, that's precisely why the early church is struggling with the fact that when Gentiles become Christians, do they also have to fit into this block? Not do they obey the law or should they have some moral responsibility. I think that's become a big debate in Christianity about the place of the law. And my own tradition, which is a Reformed tradition, is slightly different to the Lutheran tradition on the place of the law for the Christian. But the point that seems to be coming is that, and that with the passages we're dealing with, is do Christians have to go through this box to reach salvation?
I think you're right on, because in chapter 6 of Acts 2, where the disagreement with the widows of the Hellenists were being neglected in the daily distribution, that was a cultural thing and linguistic, because really the proper translation there is the Greek-speaking Jews or widows. And that had to do with people that came from the diaspora and were living in Jerusalem, and their customs and their ways were different than the people that were living there, the Hebrew-speaking Jews. So that thing had already surfaced long before, this thing.
It becomes an issue and a struggle, and should that happen. Now, how does, in terms of what we read in those two passages, how does the early church, or how does Paul respond to this question, Peter or Paul, that Christians have got to go through all of this to come out the other end and be saved, which is what that group of people is trying to push on.
I have a question. In the translation, are there separate words in the Greek for for a law that is a law that's set up by man versus a law that is a universal law of God? I'm not aware that there is. But it seems in reading the Romans passage that there's two senses of the word law there. And one would be the cultural ethnic thing we've been talking about, and the other is kind of a universal God's law,
the Ten Commandments
issue. And I think that I didn't get a lot of help from the end of the reading in Romans, because it does say that you're justified on the grounds of your faith alone. And then he asks, do we then overthrow the law by this faith? By no means. On the contrary, we uphold the law. So he said yes and no, which makes you think that there's got to be one set of universal laws that's going to apply to everybody. And then if there are certain groups within that choose to have other laws that set them apart as a particular grouping or subgrouping, then it seems that that's all right.
Yeah, I think that's a useful thing to point out, is that the law, and from what I can understand, I think this is where the Reformation really struggled with the concept of the law, is precisely, is Paul talking about the Ten Commandments, which is what particularly Calvin saw as the law? When he talks about the law, it's those Ten Commandments. Or is it the whole Jewish law? I mean, the dietary things, those kinds of aspects of cultural ethnic identity. And I do think the reason why it sounds as if he's being contradictory is precisely what you point out, that there are these two understandings. And the last thing he wants is the moral responsibility of, let's say, the Ten Commandments to be lost. But he also wants to struggle with the question of do we have to go through the law in the sense of the cultural ethnic customs that have grown up. And that certainly in Scripture are given theological backing.
It seems to me that one of the things that Paul does that we have trouble with is something that's very natural to him as a Jew, and that is not to see a contradiction in something that we see a contradiction in. He sees that as a healthy tension, whereas we see it as a contradiction that has to be resolved. And I think there's something fundamentally different there in his approach, because we think so differently than he does.
Because we're Gentile.
Yes.
And I think that's what they're struggling with in the early church, is that
because
these new Christians can't understand why they have to go through that route. And that sets up the tension.
I think, Steve, I think your point is well taken in another aspect, too, is the fact that it made it easy to control the church, you see. In other words, if you can take the Jewish law and make everybody go through that path, then you had a very good control. I mean, you knew where you were.
Mm.
The gospel's open-ended. And also you had no real hope for eternal life, in the sense. And as a result of that, poor Paul would have to write even letters, more letters, because he had to go out and try and explain what they shouldn't do and can't do, and I think real problems with that. So I think that control, that's why the South African government says, if you want to, you know, be like we are, then we can control it. I think that's what the debate was.
So there's some of that going on there too.
Like the ELCA.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you think of that formation of the church. We want our own little identity. The Norwegians and Germans do.
Well, that's precisely where I want to come to now. Let me take this one point, and then I want to bring it up today to ask some questions.
So I just wondered how this all fits into this. Jesus said, "Think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I'm not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For verily I say to you, till heaven and earth pass, not one jot or tittle shall pass from the law till all be fulfilled." So how does that all fit into this?
I think that's again part of this tension, because that's from Matthew's Gospel, which is written for the Jewish community, and it's precisely struggling with that issue of how does one maintain one's Jewish identity and become a Christian? And if Jesus can be seen to be saying that not one iota or one jot of the law is gone, that kind of helps. And yet it's so clear on so many issues that he was critical of the law. You know, the Sabbath law he was willing to break. So I think that what we're touching on is part of the whole struggle. Because remember, the Gospels were written at a later stage by the winners. And we often forget that. that's part of the interpretation, part of the struggle that's gone on from Jesus' time to then, which is what I'm trying to get us into, the racial, what it must have felt like to be a rainbow church at that time, and the tensions and the struggles of having these Gentiles and these Jews who both have got different cultures and different laws, trying to be in the same church. And I think you've pointed out another passage where that kind of tension is happening.
Well, I'm really uncomfortable with this. I think it's an imposed distinction between the ceremonial law and the moral law. Okay? I don't think it's scriptural. And I think Paul views the whole thing as the law, whether it's human interpretation, the additions to Moses, and deals with it as law. And Paul was saying 1 Corinthians 9, free of the law. He's free of the whole nine yards, all of it.
As a reformed person, I would take issue with you on that. So I think Calvin and Luther had a difference on that issue, and I'm happier with Calvin on it. But could I bring it into date now? How many of you have been told, or not told, but it's been an assumption when you've gone into a church that you have to go through a box to be saved, and that box is something like what we've been talking about? How many have had an experience like that? And would we like to just throw some of these things out, and then we'll perhaps try and... What I'm trying to do is bring us into part of the crisis and the struggle of what it means to bring people of different cultures together into a church.
In many Missouri Synod Lutheran churches, you have to go through a period of instruction, even if you're a Lutheran from another synod. You have to go through a period of instruction and... some ceremony, either confirmation or reception of new members or something, in order to become a full-fledged member of the congregation or take communion.
And part of what it means to be a full-fledged member of the church and to take communion is to be saved. I mean, there's that kind of assumption. Because
to know why you're saved.
Yeah.
In our Bible class last week, one of the pastors said that he was really getting a lot of flack from congregational members because he had the new members in three classes, not six. So they had to go to six classes, you know, whether he could get everything in three or not. No, they must go to six classes in order to be a member.
So there are those kinds of laws. But now what about cultural? How many of you have become Lutherans and gone into a Swedish or a Norwegian congregation where that kind of things happened, or gone into a black congregation, or to a white congregation, or been missionaries in other cultures?
Where I was not saved unless I spoke in tongues.
Okay, so there's the whole charismatic box that one has to go through.
I had been born again as an adult instead of an infant baptism.
Yeah. Let me give you an example from South Africa. The missionaries came. And in order for black South Africans to be saved, if you really pushed them, they wouldn't say this, but it's part of what comes across is that they had to wear suits. The men had to wear suits to come to church, because that's what being a Christian is. Do you see what I'm getting at? I mean, what we're doing is that you've got this whole British, English or German or European thing on what being a Christian is. And now you go out and you bring new people in and you say, but in order to come to our church, which, as I said, if you push them, that's not what salvation means, but in the common mind, that's what being saved and being a Christian is coming to our church. You have to wear a suit, or you have to speak Norwegian, or you have to do, you know, you have to sing and keep your body still, or you have to not dance in church. I mean, there's a whole lot of laws that we've got at that kind of level. Yeah,
I think that's where part of the tension that I hear you saying, that even it's a lot of the conversation here, that tension is between what the expectations are to be accepted by the people, as opposed, like you say, if you push them, it's not the salvation that they would say. You don't have to wear a suit to church. But even in our own in Lutheran churches, there's a hidden agenda in terms of you have to dress up in order to go to church, and in order to be accepted there. Otherwise, you get, you know, strange looks and people kind of move away from you when you sit in the pew, and those kinds of things. And so it's not directly related to salvation, but it is related to being in relationship with the other people within the church.
For being part of the church community. I want to come back to that question of the relationship between the church and salvation towards the end, which is getting close. But So we're asking the question is, maybe it's just that if you really push them, nobody's going to say you won't be saved if you don't wear a suit. But where the line is drawn is that please don't come to our church unless you wear a suit.
I'm in a low socioeconomic black area of Chicago, and the most frequent response that I get from people when I'm out evangelizing on the streets is, we can't come to your church because we don't have anything to wear but jeans. And I mean, that's it. Their assumption is they can't come.
And we've set up a whole grid. Kind of, what I don't know, it seems to me that's part of the struggle that Paul is dealing with, or that the early church is facing, is just, you know, do we have to look, what are our faces like? I mean, lipstick or not, or bearded or not, you know, I mean, there are so many of these kinds of things going on there.
Well, and then what the Christian church did to the Jews after that.
Yeah.
By 381, you could no longer culturally be a Jew and a believer in Jesus Messiah.
Okay, so let's keep that one here. What happens to the Jews? Because that's the good question that gets asked. Okay, now, the early church didn't go this route. They chose route, as some Americans said. The early church didn't go this route. just wondering, route is the only thing. Route? Yeah, that's great. What they've been smoking, okay.
Geographically.
Because through the work of theologians, practical theologians, hopefully what you've seen today is that the kinds of forums and debates that go on in a place like Holden are very similar to the kinds of forums and debates that Paul and Peter and Barnabas and those folks were getting themselves thrown into, trying to decide, in the light of Jesus Christ, how we all hang together. Now, they didn't go this way. They went another way. From what we've read, what are some of the tricks that Paul pulled to get out of this setup? And it was pointed to here originally that what Paul does is that he explores the law not as a set of things that you have to follow, but rather a covenantal relationship of faith. And he'll go on in Romans to talk about, was Abraham saved by faith or by the law? And he sets up this whole kind of thing that in fact the heart of the law is faith. In other words, even if he says it at the beginning of chapter 3, you can be circumcised in your body, but still uncircumcised in your heart. So what then is the purpose of circumcision, if not an outward symbol of an inward reality? Sounds awfully Eucharistic, but anyway. for faith. Yes, that's right. I mean, it's that, we're in that kind of thing. And so what he does is, I mean, if one wants to look at it as the trick he pulls, but where his brilliance comes is that he explores this whole context of law as something more than just those regulations that you have to follow day after day, but as an attitude of heart, a circumcision of the heart. And that enables the Gentiles to come in, because they can also get to faith. If faith is the essence of the law, then you don't have to obey everything in the law to get to faith. In fact, you might not even have to obey any of it. But the common denominator is faith. And both have access to that, Gentile and Jew. Because why? Because God, through the work of the Holy Spirit, gives faith to people. And that is the way Paul gets himself out of, or gets the early church out of it, and becomes the issue. Now, just going back to Luther, that was the struggle, you see, that Luther was, for the German people were being told to go through all the Catholic laws, and maybe there's some kind of ethnic racial tension here between what became Germany and what became Italy, in order to reach salvation. And what he's saying is, no, it's through faith. But what I really want to hold up to you, and particularly in this day and age, that it's that the dynamic is not simply between following the law and having faith, but that it's a whole cultural struggle that the church is going through. It's the whole rainbow struggle, really, that the early church faces. And in fact, you might even find some churches where faith becomes the box through which you have to believe in I mean, you have to believe in justification by faith to become a good Christian. You know, I mean, instead of having to believe in Jesus Christ, you have to believe that believing in Jesus Christ.
Yes.
It gets you in. So that this whole thing itself has become a box.
Instead of believing that God has saved you by grace through Christ, you have to believe, and it's your strength of your belief that enables you to be saved.
So the box, in fact, can become anything. I mean, that you may. In fact, it can become this system as well. I mean, this whole whiteboard, could become a box itself. You know, that you have to believe what Steve DeGrucci on the Bible study said in order to become a Christian. Well, that's rubbish. And I think that's part of the struggle that Paul is getting into. And in the final minutes, perhaps, what do you think that means for a church that is struggling with racial and cultural tensions? There's a school of church growth that believes the quickest way to grow your churches and to get them rich is to have racially homogenous and ethnically homogenous and culturally homogenous communities.
Steve?
Sorry.
I think, after the little faith box there, then I think we need another arrow to point to a box, no, the one that's down there, another arrow pointing to law, because then God works the law out in our hearts. We don't want to just totally disregard the law. It's like we don't want the law and the cultural things to have to come before the faith. But individually, then God writes the laws on our hearts and shows us individually maybe which law to that we can handle first and then what. Because so many times people say, disregard the law. You know, it's just by faith. And yet the faith comes first and then the law, but God is the one that writes it on our hearts. God is the one that shows us what we need to do. And so I think we need to maybe add that somewhere so that we don't just,
Yeah, I mean, that becomes there is no such thing as pure faith. I mean, faith has historical expressions. And that means it has to be done in a culture. And culture has ways of relating. And in order to make sense, you have to fit into that. You know. So you're justified by faith, but your faith has to work itself out. And now, not just by the sins we pray in the prayer of confession what we did and what we did not do as well. I mean, sometimes our culture is good and we have to obey that part, but sometimes our culture is bad and our faith has to work itself out in opposition to the culture. But the point is that the faith and the law and the culture thing, what I'm not saying here, and hopefully that point has made that clear, is that one has just got to bypass moral responsibility or human historical media in which this takes place. But that the faith that where Paul really makes the point is that faith becomes the issue through which it goes. I think that connects here somewhere. I mean, if I started writing Spirit and Law, it would get a little bit. But it, you know what? What reminds me of is how many of you saw the movie The Mission? Yeah, you remember that conflict where they're telling the Indians to go back to the thing because God has told the king to do that. And the Indian chief says, am I not a king? Well, God's spoken to me too. You know? And it's that kind of thing that what's happened is that the spirit has been captured in that kingdom, by that king, in that set of laws. And here's another person, a Christian, saying, hey, but God's spirit can also speak to me. You know, am I not a ruler or whatever? That just struck me as a good example of where the church itself wasn't allowing the spirit to move, but had been captured by a certain box, which in this case was it Portuguese or Spanish, in Brazil. And that's a kind of tension where we only allow the spirit to speak through the box, the priest. What about Paul himself? Because what about the woman ministers questioning Paul, for example? Was Paul able to ever stand outside his culture so much that he could simply make that thing? Or don't we even have to struggle with Paul himself, that Paul was caught in the box? Is that...
I think so. I think we're all caught in the box. That's a cultural inescapability, I think, to some degree.
So was Luther.
Yeah. And, but do you think we can almost use Paul's system to critique Paul? I mean, that's our hope, isn't it?
Please.
But, and that it's not your face, you know, whether you've got lipstick on or whether you've got short hair and a beard, that brings you to salvation, but your faith, and that therefore it's not the outward appearance. And maybe one would want to say that Paul really struggled with the Jew-Gentile issue, and but simply bought into the whole Jewish cultural legacy on the place of women in the believing community. So I guess what I'm saying is that I think that this can become a self-critiquing thing. It's precisely when you've set it up that you have to use it against yourself. I wanted to just, in the final minutes, talk about this connection, because church and salvation, because this connects with South Africa, and it might also make some sense here. Because you see, at some levels, in a kind of liberal, post-enlightenment conception, the church is simply a group of individuals, like a bridge club or a golf club. And so people somehow work on the assumption that, okay, we won't allow you into our church, but you can still be saved, you know, on the suits issue or the language issue. But what the church in South Africa is really struggling with, and its primary critique of apartheid in the church, is it's precisely the church community which is the symbol and the community of those who have faith. And to deny somebody access to your church, or to set up a boundary in your church, is precisely to set up a boundary to faith. Without pointing fingers in terms of the Dutch Reformed Church, because it's the English-speaking church, is exactly the same at deeper levels. But the Dutch Reformed Church is split very basically into settler churches and mission churches. And these are white and these are black in South Africa. And they both are Dutch Reformed churches. So the confession and the ecclesiology and... Sorry, that's a big word. I mean, the way the church goes together is the same. It's not different denominations. So it's not as if these are Lutheran and these are Calvinist or Catholic and Lutheran. These are both Reformed, Dutch Reformed churches. But the issue that simply divides them is the white-black thing. Now, what they were saying, look, it's not that you don't belong to our church that you're not saved. Just belong to your church where you can speak your language, sing your hymns, where your clothes have your pastors. Well, actually, we'll give you pastors. That's part of the missionary ethic. But it's setting it up like that, you see. And what they're saying is, fine. I mean, it happens in the world that people like to have fellowship with people who speak the same language and sing the same hymns. That's not the point. The point is that what you're saying about the church is that the church itself cannot transcend racial, ethnic, cultural barriers in principle. Okay, and that's part of the Dutch Reform, part of the basis of apartheid is that people principally cannot be united, because at the Tower of Babel God separated them up. It's part of God's will that people are separate in different ethnic and racial groups in different parts of the world. So the church can't come along and undo God's will of Babel. But the thing is that what we're learning now is that salvation is not just an individual thing, but salvation is how it affects me in fellowship with somebody else. And if we're saying that there are physical reasons, my blackness against your whiteness, or my South Africanness against your Americanness, or whatever, that mean we cannot belong to the same church, then what are we saying? That Christ's death on the cross couldn't bridge that gap. And if Christ's death on the cross couldn't bridge that gap, well, we're right into the heart of salvation here. You know, I mean, that's Christ's death on the cross. That's not some kind of little thing for Christians. Is it? I mean, where do Lutherans stand on that issue? So what I'm wanting to say is that I think so often, because we see salvation as individualistic and the church as the aggregation of those individuals who are saved, we don't make this link. But in fact, the church should be the community precisely where the salvation of the breaking down of the walls between us is evident. So I want to just raise a critical question about setting up ethnic, cultural, whatever divisions in the church. In principle, look, I mean, I'm aware that in practice, people like to worship with people of the same kind. But if you say that your church won't allow that in all, even if you don't say it in the Constitution, if that's the ethos given off by the membership, well, I think you're getting into salvation at that point. One last point, Jerry.
I was just wondering what you meant by salvation, or how you... Could you say something?
I have a 10-week lecture series beginning. Well, that could just take forever. Yeah. What I'm trying to open it up to a bit more is that, so what happens on the cross is not just that we are reconciled to God, but that the possibility of our reconciliation to others happens. And that for me is what salvation is. And that means that the church is a symbol of something of what's going on there. Now, I guess also I need to just put the disclaimer on here is that the church is always going to fail at that. And I hardly want to set up the church as the perfect community of everybody who's saved. But I think that's what the church has to at least profess itself to be. You know?
It has to make that effort continuously.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they're bridging the economics too.
Sorry?
It's bridging, trying to bridge the economics. It's not only that people are black and white in South Africa, but on the other hand, you give us we want a right to vote so we can have different economic situations in which they're entitled.
Right.
And we haven't touched it yet.
So, okay, so part of those ethnic divisions in the United States would be black, white, rich, poor, English-speaking, Spanish-speaking, men and women. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on here. But what I was hoping through the Bible study is that this isn't new. I mean, this is where the church had its roots, in Paul's struggle. And that we can see justification by faith is not some kind of thing that gives us access into heaven, but is a working principle for dealing with the rainbow. That's a good place to stop. Okay.